The topic that I was assigned is, quite frankly, far more than I would be able to cover in a series of sermons, let alone in 45 minutes. So we're going to skim rather quickly through the concepts that I was assigned to discuss. And in so doing, we will, well, this is not my normal sermons on the home. And because I am asked to dig deeper than I normally do in presenting sermons on the home, and I don't know that these questions have been addressed ever among us. I don't remember having some of these questions addressed among us at all. And so with that in mind, I'm thrilled to have the challenge. But hang on, there's some interesting things here. And for those of you that have studied these concepts, this will be old hat to you. For the rest of us, we will ponder these concepts together. And so, the first question is, what is Paul's point in Ephesians 5 when he compares the relationship of Christ and the church to husbands and wives? Well, we are accustomed to God revealing himself in one era, or revealing a concept in one era that has significance in another time. We're familiar with that. In fact, in Numbers, we have the fiery serpent, or the brass serpent, that was lifted upon a pole. When you read that account, it makes no sense that that would be the solution to the problem of Israel's sin. But it all comes together quite nicely when Jesus himself, in addressing Nicodemus, refers to it in John 3:14, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And so we have one thing in one era that has significance in another. And similarly, when we look to Ephesians 5, we have the Lord's church and Christ's relationship with the church compared to marriage, with references to the garden scene when God created woman, who is the crown jewel of all of God's creation, and presented her to Adam, pronouncing them man and wife. And so, in verses 23 and 24, we have God saying through Adam, "This is bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." This is repeated in Ephesians chapter 5, because we have in verse 30, "We're members of his body, of his flesh, of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh." This is a great mystery, the Bible declares, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. And so, in Ephesians 5, we have a clear link to the garden scene from so long ago. One is created from the other. From Adam's flesh and bones is created Eve, and from Christ's flesh and bones is created the church, according to Ephesians 5. And so the mystery is not that of marriage, because marriage had existed from the time of the garden. And Ephesians chapter 5 is not the only time that God has addressed husband and wife relationships. Sometimes we think we don't have anything significant about marriage until we get to Ephesians 5. But the Old Testament has sufficient revelation for all to have appropriate marital relationships in Old Testament times and in New Testament times. And so one of the considerations that we would mention is that woman was created to be a helper, meet, or suitable from the side of Adam. Genesis 2:18. Adam was created first. Since Eve was created from him, Adam was created first, and by virtue of the order of creation, there was intended to be always a voluntary yielding on the part of Eve to the more senior Adam. This has nothing to do with the fall and has everything to do with the sequence or order of creation. We know this has significance because 1 Timothy 2:13 says, "For Adam was first formed, then Eve." And so, we also have that the woman was created for the man. Now, since Adam was created first, establishing leadership, he had responsibilities. And when he listened to the sinful choice that she presented, by virtue of the order of creation, she had an obligation to turn to him for guidance and help, something she did not do. He, by virtue of the order of creation, had an obligation to lead his family in righteousness rather than follow in disobedience. And so God to Adam said, because thou hast hearkened to the voice of thy wife. And that is Genesis 3, verse 17. Now, it wasn't wrong for him to listen to her, but it was wrong for him to listen to her in her presentation of disobedience and succumb or make the decision, the deliberate decision, to follow her in her sin. So we have woman created for the man, Genesis 2:18, and we have woman created from man, Genesis 2 and verse 21. And we also have that the woman was named by the man, and that is in Genesis 2 and verse 23. This is an amazing scripture, this Genesis 2:23, as all of these are. In the Hebrew, there's a play on words, if you will, where the word for man is ish, and the word for woman is ishah. And so that's what Adam is talking about. She shall be called woman or ishah because she was taken out of man or ish. And literally in the Hebrew, the word for Eve means she man. And so we have then a woman from the time of creation and for all time thereafter, the only one who can fulfill the type of one flesh relationship that man can have that is blessed by God. And so that has been established clearly from the garden, from the time of creation. And this one flesh relationship is revealed in the garden, repeated by Jesus himself, and also by the Apostle Paul. Now, regardless of evidence of Old Testament times when women were not treated appropriately, there were still sufficient guidelines for great marriages to exist in all of those centuries. For example, the virtuous woman of Proverbs 31 and her husband. What an amazing family. What a great love-filled relationship they had as husband and wife, as a great example for their children. She showed him the greatest of respect so that when he sat at the gate as one of the city elders, he had nothing to be ashamed of because of his family. And he loved her and praised her. And the children saw that example of husband and wife relationship as all who could see them and know them. Ezekiel and his wife had a wonderful relationship. Ezekiel's wife is called the desire or the delight of his eyes. And that is just an amazing compliment to the relationship that they had as husband and wife. Abraham and Sarah, now they had some issues. And what marriage among us hasn't had some issues here and there. But they had a wonderful relationship. One that is used as an example in many particular ways. Now Job and his wife. Oh, I put bad wife up there. And after they'd lost everything. And it was just a time for mourning, and it was just a horrible time with all that Satan was doing to Job, was when his wife said in Job 2, verse 9, dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die. Just get it over with, is what she's saying. And here was his response to her. Dost thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh? What, shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? What did Job do? Did he call her a foolish woman? Yes. And the reason he could is because she was. At least in this instance, she was. Now, the last part of verse 10 says, in all this did not Job sin with his lips. So he told the truth when he said to his wife, you're talking like a foolish woman. Now, there's one more time when we see Job's wife, Job 19, verse 17, where he says, evidently they'd had another conversation. And he said, my breath is strange or offensive to my wife. Evidently, she came out long enough to say, oh, you got bad breath. That's just not a good help in times like these with all he was going through. And so I've got bad wife by her. Nabal and Abigail, bad husband. Oh, man, what a bad husband. Abigail is described, 1 Samuel 25:3, a woman of good understanding and of a beautiful countenance. But it says, and the man was churlish and evil in his doings. You talk about an amazing word. It's the word churlish. That's just really a descriptive word to say. It's not a compliment to anybody. Now, what we read in Ephesians, therefore, should not be seen as anything new or seen as a surprise, because the characteristics of a great marriage are things that men and women had concluded from the Scriptures and could have known had they chosen to from the beginning. And so, I believe that Paul's point was that everyone of maturity in his audience would know what a marriage was supposed to be, whether or not they practiced it. Therefore, they had a point of beginning from the oldest relationship institution, the home, to understand the newest and greatest institution, the relationship of Christ in the church, which is the great mystery or the great secret revealed. Now, what came first, Christ or the church? Well, Christ did, of course. He is the one who came first, not only as the eternally existent Son of God, but also as the firstborn from the dead. And this is significant because Colossians 1:18 says, He is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things He might have the preeminence. And so just as there was to be a recognized sequence of leadership from the creation sequence in the garden between Adam and Eve, we must bow before Jesus as supreme in the Lord's church. This then is the mystery revealed to mankind. And so then Paul is inspired to use the greater to enlarge upon the lesser and to bring it up to date. And certainly the original sanctity of marriage looks forward to Christ and the church, but now that the greater, the church, has been established, there can be logical conclusions drawn to enrich marriage. And so that is what God is doing, saying to both husband and wife, submit to the assigned roles for you. And so husbands are to occupy their role as leader and love their wife, not after the example of Adam, but after the example of Christ. And wives are told, occupy your role as follower and helper in respect to your husband, not after the example of Eve, but after the example of God's image for the church, the bride of Christ. And so we have then these quotes, the expositor's Greek testament. The sense, therefore, is this: the truth of which I've spoken, the relation of husband and wife as one flesh, is a revelation of profound importance, but let me explain that in speaking of it as I have done, my meaning is to direct your minds to that higher relation between Christ and His church in its likeness, which lies its deepest significance. Kaufman says, the exalted view both of marriage and of the church of Jesus Christ shines forth in this text. The sacredness of marriage is seen in God's design of it from the very beginning. To be a figure of the union of Christ and His church and the glorious importance of the church appears in the fact of its having been in the design of God from the very beginning. Again, using something significant from one era that becomes amazing in the next. Okay. Now, we could have spent another hour on that first question, you know, but we're going to need to hasten on to number two. Are Christian couples commanded to have children? One of the aspects of the one flesh relationship that is spoken of in the garden and by Christ and by Paul is that of physical intimacy. This is because of the natural gift of desire. There is an address about this, this concept of desire, in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 7. It is the intention of the Creator, as male and female, that we would be created with the capacity to physically express that desire. And when that desire is expressed appropriately between husband and wife, one of the natural consequences can be a child. And so children from the beginning have been considered a natural consequence of marriage, as introduced in the garden when the pain of childbirth was discussed. Now, whenever we first read about the pain of childbirth, it is our introduction both to childbirth and its concept and to the concept of pain in the same. But it is the pain of childbirth that is being referred to as increasing in intensity, and it is not childbirth itself that is the punishment. And so, Genesis 3:16, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow or in pain thou shalt bring forth children. Thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. So, only looking at the pain part of this verse, that is the sentence as a result of the fall, is that while childbirth is natural, it was going to be more complicated because of the fall that had happened. Now, while childbirth is to be considered a natural part of a husband and wife relationship, it is not a guarantee. While a marriage can exist without physical intimacy, if physical intimacy is possible in a marital relationship, a result of that union may be the conception of children, but that is not always the case for various reasons. Now, there have been times in history when God did bless / command there to be offspring. One of those is in the garden, God's will for animals: be fruitful, multiply, fill the waters and the seas, let the fowl multiply in the earth. God's will for Adam and Eve in the beginning was that God blessed them. And then God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Now, the replenish word here doesn't mean that they were replacing something that existed before. That word can also just mean fill. And that is what the Lord is saying to them: fill the earth. And so in the case of Adam and Eve, there were only two humans. From them came sufficient children to fill the earth with all of humankind. God did not create additional humans, but allowed the passing of time and natural birth, the natural birth process, to fill the earth. So the first marriage is that of Adam and Eve. The next marriage that's announced is Cain taking a wife, Genesis 4:17. That had to be one of his sisters. And if you're saying, ooh, yuck, I understand. But understand that this was the first of many brothers and sisters who married, and cousins, in order to fulfill God's command. Genesis 4:17, Cain knew his wife. She conceived, bare Enoch. He builded a city, called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. Now, the family sizes pre-flood would have been somewhat large, larger than we can possibly imagine. And so after Adam had Seth with Eve, he lived another 800 years. And it says he begat sons and daughters. We know he had two in order for Cain to have a wife and for there to be future generations. Okay, after Seth begat Enos, he lived 807 years and begat sons and daughters. And so this command to Adam to fill or replenish the earth was fulfilled, because all of the earth appears to have been fully populated by the time of Noah. And so, in the time of Noah, it's pretty interesting to look at some calculators for how long people lived and how many children they might have had to see how many people could have lived on the tropical paradise that would have been the entire planet in those days. And you can get to a lot of billions of people really quick, really easy. And so even a conservative estimate is that there could have easily been an average of around 10 billion people alive on the face of the earth pre-flood. And then there were eight. All of those people died except for eight. And so we are left with Noah, his three sons, their wives. And these are the generations of them. And it says, and unto them were sons born after the flood, and also daughters of necessity, because they started over. After the flood, we see a very familiar command given. God's will for the animals, go multiply. God's will for mankind, go multiply. And it was a blessing, and it was a command. Blessed to go do this, and commanded to do it as well. Now, after the flood, remember, lifespans were reduced, but families could still be amazingly large. Abijah had 22 sons and 16 daughters from 14 wives. Abdon, and remember, that was tolerated in those days, and it's not anything we can do today, thank you. Abdon, 40 sons, no mention of daughters. Gideon, at least 71 children from many wives and a concubine. Rehoboam, 88 children from 18 wives and 60 concubines. Solomon mentions in Ecclesiastes 6 verse 3, if a man begat 100 children, which he likely had and more from his 700 wives and 300 concubines. So where are we today in the population of the world? Well, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, we're around 7.3 billion. So does that mean we need another 3 billion people and we need to hurry up and try to do that? I don't think so, because I do not believe that we are still under the blessing / command to be fruitful and multiply, because I believe that blessing command was only to those to whom it was directly addressed. And so the blessing would have been down at the bottom, you will be able to fulfill that command. The command was, you must have as many children as you possibly can, and you must not refuse to have children. And so when the Lord told Adam and Eve, here's your blessing, be fruitful. And when he told Noah and Noah's three sons, here's your blessing, be fruitful. I think this was directly to them, and that they had an absolute obligation to do their best to fulfill it. Well, after that, we see that there were some special circumstances. We see that Israel was said to be as the stars of the sky and the sands of the seashore. And so Deuteronomy 10:22 says, thy fathers went down into Egypt with 70 persons, and now the Lord thy God hath made thee as the stars of heaven for multitude. And so that was fulfilled. That was exactly what God blessed them to do. We have a special circumstance in Abraham and Sarah regarding the birth of Isaac. And so while there were miraculous circumstances involved in his conception, Abraham and Sarah still had to cooperate with God's command in order for him to exist and be born. They were not to refuse God and his special gift in order to produce a child. Israel's land ownership, and we've already touched on this verse earlier in the study, Israel's land ownership depended upon a family's future generations. There were some special circumstances, some special commands to make sure this happened. In Deuteronomy 25, if a man died without children, his brother or a nearest kinsman was to raise up children on the deceased person's behalf. And so Onan refused to cooperate with God's command. And in this particular case, I believe the reason that Onan was slain is because he refused to obey the command and the blessing to have a child on his brother's behalf. And so, in each case that we look at, those commanded to have children plentifully, those directly commanded to have children plentifully, Adam and Eve and Noah and his sons and his wives, did so to the absolute best of their ability. Then their offspring continued to have children as they desired and as they were naturally capable, and the natural birth rate was sufficient for the world to be populated as God intended. And so with that said, I know of nothing in the scriptures that commands Christians that they absolutely must have children today. Now, third question. What does the Bible say about Christians who choose marriage but refuse to have children? Well, the question becomes, can God regulate something that is not required? Well, let's start with marriage. God regulates marriage. Hebrews 13 and 4, marriage is honorable in all, and the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. And this truth is enlarged by God's revelation limiting who may marry. There are individuals who can get themselves in situations where they are not eligible to marry again because of divorce situations. And so we work through passages like 1 Corinthians 7 and Matthew 5:32, Matthew 19:9, Romans 7:1-3. We work through these in order to understand how God regulates marriage, but the regulation of marriage should never be seen as a command to marry. In fact, Paul explains it's fine for individuals to never marry. 1 Corinthians 7:1, It's good for a man not to touch a woman. And that has to do with intimacy, which the appropriate setting for that, of course, is marriage. 1 Corinthians 7, there is a comparison there to someone who is single and able to dedicate all of their energies to God's service versus someone who is married and therefore must also direct their energies towards their home. God's not saying that it's sinful to marry. He's saying that there's divided interest. And so there is a regulation of marriage, and I would submit that these concepts are only possible if the command to be fruitful and multiply is not a New Testament command. Otherwise, if all must have children, then all must marry. Since marriage is the blessed relationship for the production of children. Now, in similar fashion, God does regulate the raising of children. Ephesians 6, verses 1 through 4 and other passages, women are to be taught, younger women are to be taught how to love their children if they have them. And since having children is considered a natural consequence of being married, there is regulation of having children, but I see nothing in the scriptures that requires couples to do so. We do see at times there was limitations on marriage. During the special circumstances of the present distress at Corinth, Paul advised people not to marry during that time, although if they chose to do so, they had not sinned. 1 Corinthians 7, 26 through 28. We also see an encouragement to have children in such passages as 1 Timothy 5, verses 9 and 14. And so in those passages, verse 9 says, "Let not a widow be taken into the number," referring to those who would be supported by the church, "under 80 years old or under 60 years old. And then there's qualifications given that she must meet in order to be worthy of support by the church. And verse 14 says, "I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully." So in this setting, it appears the passage is saying, any widow who is younger than 60 is advised to marry to have children. But I don't believe that this is a command to have children, because women, many, will be past the age of the ability to do so in those years, closer to 60. And besides, they may not be asked to marry anyone. And so what is a younger widow to do? Go tackle a man and say, "You are going to marry me?" That's not at all what is being referred to here. This is intended as a deterrent to evil behavior, as a deterrent to fornication, that marriage is encouraged and suggested. It does not mean she must marry, because she may not have opportunity. And it does not mean that she is commanded to have children if she does, because having a child is dependent upon many factors of individual health in both men and women. Well, when we look at more modern day practices, we have what happened with Onan as an example of birth control from long ago. And I would submit that had he not been under the command to raise up a child from his brother, had he been in the confines of his home with his wife, the practice of birth control, even in those days, would have been their choice and their decision. Now, when couples who otherwise could have children choose to have no children, I know of no scripture that demands that they must. And it appears to me that the scriptures are very silent on that particular issue. And so perhaps we can apply what Brother Jim Rogers writes in his book regarding the apostolic pattern, that when the scriptures are silent regarding individual action, that individuals are freed until restricted, and therefore men and women are freed to either have children or not have children. However, I do suggest that couples need to very carefully examine their reasons, whether having children or not having children, because there is a natural desire for children. There is a natural desire in the heart of men and women. And when individuals can have children but choose to not do so, they do so at the price of leaving that natural desire unfulfilled. They are missing the joy of being of having both children and grandchildren, and grandchildren are best I'll just tell you. Those of you that don't have them yet, hang in there. I really wish we could have had grandkids first, and it would have almost made raising our kids worthwhile. Almost, okay? They are such a joy, and that's what is being declared, the joy of having children. Psalms 127, verse 3, lo, children are an heritage of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is His reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed. And Proverbs 17, 6, children's children or grandchildren are the crown of old men, and the glory of children are their fathers. If you want to see somebody light up, just talk to them about their grandkids, especially when they're young. Now they grow up, and that's another thing. But especially when they're young and when they're sweet. Now, someone who chooses deliberately to not have children are saying that is something we choose to live without, that joy. They're missing the opportunity for the man of the family to be considered in leadership positions of both elder and deacon, because there must be children in the family as part of those qualifications. Couples who refuse to have children are missing a great opportunity to bear fruit for future generations of the Lord's church. And statistically, we convert our children more frequently than we convert people of the world. And so in many instances around the country, there are congregations who, because of no children or because of the lack of faithfulness among the children, are just simply dying and will not continue to be in existence long. Having children, of course, does not guarantee that they will be converted to Christ and be faithful. Just having a child is no guarantee at all. But we are statistically better off if we will evangelize in our own home first, and statistically more successful. Well, today's numbers of having children have varied quite a bit in the last 60 years or so. In 1957, the average number of children per family was 3.6. Today it's 2.6, and that is all of America put together. Now, within the cultures that exist in America, there are certain cultures who statistically raise that number to the 2.6 that it is. But there are among whites, for example, a much lower average number of children in all of our families. Now, and we're fairly conforming to that statistical model in the Lord's church. But the power of natural desire is an amazing concept. 86% of Americans 45 or older have had children. And 9 out of 10 of these say they would do it over again. And of the ones who have not had children, most of them wish they had. And so the natural desire for children is alive and well on planet Earth. And it is something that is going to continue, because that is how God made us. That is how He made us. Okay, some believe that having children is the only reason for the one flesh relationship. And that is not the case. There is to be due benevolence in 1 Corinthians 7, and that literally is presented as a debt of intimacy that is owed that either spouse can claim payment for. And so, being very careful to be appropriate, due benevolence speaks to the mutual pleasure that is intended in the one flesh relationship that is between husband and wife. Whenever a couple are considering marriage, there needs to be very serious discussion about children. And there needs to be serious discussion about whether or not there is a desire for children on the part of both. And if there is, what is the number that would be approximately appropriate to fulfill their dreams and their goals? Now, many a young couple start off saying, we're going to have a football team, until one or two happens and they say, you know what, a basketball team, or maybe a tennis player would be just fine, you know. But that discussion needs to be had. And it not only needs to be had with the possibility of numbers of children, there needs to be serious consideration given to what if we are unable to naturally have children. for one reason or the other. What if we are not able to have children? Of course, any couple desiring children but unable to have them naturally can adopt to be able to share their love with the child of their choice. But those discussions need to be had before we say, I do, or else there can be severe issues and problems in the relationship. Okay, number four. 1 Timothy 2:15, and the woman saved in childbearing. This is rather a thorny issue. Here's the contextual setting, 1 Timothy 2, and some of these concepts we've already looked at in our time together. A woman is to learn in silence with all subjection. A woman is not to teach nor usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence. Why? Because Adam was first formed than Eve. That's where I went to say, the sequence of headship in the home was established by order of creation, had nothing to do with the fall. But also, Adam was not deceived, but the one being deceived was in the transgression. Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety. Now, what I'm about to plunge into is way beyond my knowledge, okay? But I will share with you what I have studied, and we can learn together. But as far as being an expert in the original Greek of the Word of God, I am not. However, here's what I know. The Bible is true at any level. When we have an appropriate translation of God's Word, it is true on the surface. When we dig deep into the meanings of the words of the original language, the Bible is still true. And so, we're not only going to look at the surface a little bit, but we're going to dig just a little more into this particular passage to see some things that may not be apparent in the translation that we would look at. Okay, so Homer Kent, in his commentary, offers four different views of this verse. Now, this is 4 of 40 that you can find on this particular passage. It's considered a thorny passage. One of those views is that of physical salvation in childbirth. Another of the views is that of spiritual salvation through childbirth. Another is that of spiritual salvation in the home. Another is spiritual salvation through the incarnation of Christ. And all of those, at first glance, may have some absolute validity and some appeal to us. But the first one, physical salvation in childbirth, that would insinuate that every woman having a child will physically thrive and live. And that's not so. The Centers for Disease Control, when I looked at that, they said approximately 600 women a year die with complications of the result of pregnancy or delivery, with thousands more dying around the world. And so, well, let's dismiss that one and move on. The spiritual salvation through childbirth. So this is saying that any woman who has a child is going to be saved in heaven. Well, now let's think about that. What this says is that this is another path of salvation. It's another plan of salvation, separate and apart from what the Bible teaches in the plan of salvation. If this is true, it leaves women who cannot bear children, it leaves them unsaved. If this is a requirement for women, it leaves them unsaved. And so this one has a lot of complications, although you'll find things about the first and this second in a lot of commentaries dating back through centuries of time. The third one is spiritual salvation in a home with children view. And while a woman is to guide the home or to be a homemaker, that does not require children in order for her to be described as a keeper of her home. Now, one example being Abraham and Sarah had no children for a long, long time. Remember that? And same with the parents of John the Baptist. No children in their home. But yet, the duties in the home, except for those of caring for children, would have remained the same. Okay. So this particular view then of spiritual salvation through the incarnation of Christ and following after Kent in his comments seems to be the more likely interpretation. And so let's look at that in this way. In this passage, there's a switch from the singular to the plural that becomes very significant. And so it says, notwithstanding she, singular in nature, shall be saved in childbearing if they, plural in nature. So we have something going on that's quite significant. And the she refers to the previous verse, identified as the woman in verse 14, and named in verse 13 as Eve. So this verse starts out talking about Eve. She that is saved in childbearing is Eve. But it switches to they. And so immediately, there's a much larger audience than just Eve. And the they then would refer to all women who meet the conditions of faith, charity, and holiness with sobriety. And so we have some other things in this particular passage that can help us with its understanding. We have an untranslated article. In the original, there is the little word that is translated thee, and that did not come through on my PowerPoint. Sorry, it's not TH equals dollars. So that font didn't translate too well. And so the phrase in the original, notwithstanding, she shall be saved in the childbearing. Now, we're familiar with concepts like that because in Jude, we have the faith that was once delivered, not just faith. So there's a particular, peculiar faith or body of evidence that is being referred to. And so in this case, the childbearing indicates a definite and particular event rather than just childbearing in general. So she shall be saved in the childbearing. Well, what special event is that referring to? And it's very common, according to Strong's, that particular article sometimes is omitted in translation. So we shouldn't be upset over the fact that it is left out, but it does help us in our understanding. Now, the preposition, dia, that is also in this particular passage, she shall be saved in childbearing, marks the channel connecting salvation to the first woman. So this channel is the childbearing, and it was through the seed of the woman that salvation was possible for her and for all women. So it is the channeling of an act or the making possible of an act. And so here's how this verse is paraphrased by Hohenstein. But she, Eve, shall be saved ultimately on the same plane and through the same channel as man. That is, through the childbearing, the incarnation of Christ. And this includes all women abiding in that hope, the evidence of which is faith, charity, and holiness with sobriety. Therefore, now, that's a quote from Barton W. Stone that basically says the same thing, dating back to 1834. But the result of that is no woman need despair because she is either never to marry or, if married, never able to have children. And a woman's salvation in Christ is neither guaranteed nor threatened because she does or does not have children, as far as I'm able to see from the scriptures. And so, those are the questions. And with a minute and 22 seconds to go, I'm through.